dry conditions prevailing. Right now we've got sunshine, temperature reading of 76. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up. Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have 2 different author interviews on today's program, and we want to remind you that there are also morning shows that are being offered up on the Morning Show podcast, a program tomorrow and a program on Sunday as well. If you would like to subscribe to the Morning Show podcast, go to Spotify or Google Podcast or Apple Podcast and look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. On this portion of today's morning show, we are going to be talking about what it means to be human and what it means when we live in a world that seems to be bent on dehumanization, at least in many different respects. This is a topic that has been of great interest to my guest, Adam Waits, who is Associate Professor of Management and Organizations and Social Psychologist at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management, and the author of a very interesting new book called The Power of Human, How Our Shared Humanity Can Help Us Create a Better World, published by W.W. Norton and Company. Among other things, in Professor Waits' book, he explores what it means to be human and some of the unique characteristics that set human beings apart, characteristics that we often, in a sense, take for granted or do not fully appreciate. For instance, a human being's capacity to persuade others, or the way in which our humanity can lead to very, very deep connections with others. Even in a world such as we live in now, in which there is so much automation that seems to undermine our connectedness. That and much more is explored in this book, again titled The Power of Human. So, Professor Waits, we welcome you to the morning show. I'm really happy to be speaking with you about your really, really interesting book. Briefly, how long has this particular topic, humans, dehumanization, the rise of automation, how long has this been of interest to you?
Well, this book is the culmination of basically 15 years of research on the topics of humanization and dehumanization, because those are sort of jargony terms. I'll say what they mean. Humanization is really just, in the simplest way, deep social engagement with another person, where you consider the mind behind the eyes of another person, their wants, their dreams, their thoughts, their desires, and their feelings. And then dehumanization is just the opposite, considering another person without the capacity to feel, to think, to have higher emotions, treating them as no different from an object or subhuman animal. And so I've been thinking about these things for 15 years and thinking that dehumanization has subtly been on the rise and that we should do something about it.
I want to talk about a couple of ways in which we see dehumanization play out. One of the things you say is that dehumanization tends to dominate the stereotypes or the biases that we will sometimes formulate about other people. When you talk about dehumanization in this context, are you really meaning it literally that at the root of stereotypes is a belief that somebody else is not in fact a full-blown human being? Or are you using the term dehumanization in maybe a little more subtle fashion than that?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, because there's really two forms of dehumanization. The subtle form is more when we overlook another person's capacity to think, when we simply don't notice that there's a real rational, thoughtful person on the other end of the conversation. And then there's the blatant dehumanization that I think indeed forms a lot of our biases and prejudices toward other people. And I think it's also helpful to think about dehumanization not as an on or an off switch where you're human or you're not. We see that it works more like a thermostat, where we often consider other people, particularly outgroup members, people we're at war at or people who we dislike politically, as somewhat less human than ourselves. And the reason why we know this isn't just metaphor or talk is we've done some studies where we literally ask people, we show them images of the ascent of man, this famous image that shows how humans have evolved, you know, from Neanderthal, Cro-Magnon, all the way up to Homo sapiens today. And we ask people to place different targets on that scale. You know, we ask them things like, where do you think the average American is on this scale? Where do you think the average Muslim is on this scale? Where do you think the average South American person is on this scale? And we actually do see that people will dehumanize certain groups that they dislike using that scale.
In other words, placing them lower on that scale of development. In other words,
exactly.
Regarding them perhaps still as a human being, but a lesser human being, less evolved, less developed, less accomplished, less gifted, or whatever. How about in our current political climate, where you have, for instance, supporters of our current president calling liberals snowflakes, or liberals talking about Trump voters in very kind of sweeping generalization. Is this a form of dehumanization as you are talking about it in your book?
Yes. So I think, as we're all aware, political polarization is at the highest point in recent history, perhaps in American history. And this is borne out in some dehumanization. So one study has actually shown that Democrats and Republicans will rate each other lower in terms of being evolved on the scale that I referred to earlier. In other work, people from different sides of the political aisle don't believe that their political opponents experience the same basic human sensations and emotions that they do. And so you see dehumanization coming out in that way. And in our own work, what we show is something very specific, which is that Democrats and Republicans, if you ask them, why are you in conflict with the other side? Is it out of love for your own party or hatred toward the other party? They'll say, it's out of love for my own party. But if you ask them, well, why is the other side engaged in conflict politically? They'll say, well, it's out of hatred for us, not necessarily love. So this denial of love and this emphasis on hate, I think, is another form of dehumanization as well.
You also talk at one point in your book about something that probably most of us know at least a little bit about, but I really appreciate the detail with which you share some concerns about how dehumanization often occurs within the military, and not accidentally, but
right.
There is a purposeful sort of dehumanization that goes on, particularly when it comes to the use of terminology to describe one's enemies. Remind us about that and what kind of lessons we can draw from that that might be applicable in other arenas more directly relevant to the rest of us.
Yeah. Well, so the good news is that humans have a very difficult time harming other humans. Even in the throes of war, it's not something that people want to do. We're very averse to harming others. Now, this doesn't serve us well if the goal is for conquest. So the military has increasingly taken steps to build subtle forms of dehumanization into its training, because it's much easier to harm someone if you don't consider them as fully human. That's the disturbing part. So in talking to some military folks, and including a very accomplished Green Beret, he talked about how, you know, this even functions in the language that you use to describe the person you're at war with. You don't call them, by human terms, you call them the target area, or their terms like mowing the grass. This is someone who was deployed to Afghanistan, and said this term was used to talk about essentially killing younger Afghanis in a way that they wouldn't grow into full-blown terrorists or what have you. So you can see this language gets disturbing very quickly, but its function is to make people feel like they're not, in fact, harming another human being. So that is the tension there. Mm-hmm.
I appreciate that in that same chapter, you go on to explore some of the ways in which actually humanization is actually far more valuable in terms of an effective tactic in much of what the military does, and you draw on some real-life examples, which completes the picture. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Adam Waitz, Associate Professor of Management and Organizations and Social Psychologist at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management, and the author of a book called The Power of Human, How Our Shared Humanity Can Help Us Create a Better World. I think what lots of people are talking about in terms of your book are the chapters in which you explore what it means to be human in an increasingly automated world. And and much of what you talk about in terms of humanity, dehumanization, humanization really comes into play in some fascinating real-world examples. I wonder if you could share with our listeners a really interesting little story you share that I think a lot of our listeners can relate to, which relates to a trip that you made from Chicago to Tel Aviv for a conference.
Yeah.
And the experience that you had in, I don't remember if it was the Chicago airport or the Tel Aviv airport, but it really speaks a lot to our current situation.
Yeah, so this was something that struck me a few years ago when I had to travel to a conference in Tel Aviv from Chicago. And from the moment I left my house to, I had to fly through Newark Airport, and there are all these different steps along the way, I realized from Chicago to Tel Aviv, I virtually did not interact with a single human being. So I called an Uber car from my phone. I didn't speak with the driver. I went through some express line for security. I had nobody sitting next to me on my plane from Chicago to Newark. I had forgotten my headphones and bought headphones from a vending machine at Newark Airport. I wanted food, and at Newark Airport, you can order food from an iPad, which I did. Still had no, from Newark to Tel Aviv, had no one sitting next to me. And I made it from Chicago to Tel Aviv and felt like this was one of the best travel experiences ever. No hassle, no fuss, and no humans. And then I started to reflect on that, you know, given all the conveniences we have of iPads and Uber and vending machines and this enhanced technology all around us. And I started to think about, you know, what is lost in a world where we've basically given up interactions with humans to have more convenience and efficiency. And I think there is there are some things that are lost in our increasingly automated world.
One of the points that you make in this section is that this is hitting us hard, this movement towards more and more automation in the workplace. It's hitting us hard because people identify so deeply with their work. Many of us root our sense of identity deeply in what we do and how we do it. And when we find jobs vanishing or jobs being transformed, it can be really, really devastating. And one of your bits of advice is we need to try to, first of all, work less and to base less of our identity on our jobs. I mean, it needs to have a different place in our life.
Exactly. And I think this is somewhat of a cultural belief. I know that this is a strong belief in the United States, that there's this inherent dignity to work. There's this inherent purpose that we get from work. I tell the story about how this is perhaps an apocryphal story, but a non-native English speaker comes to the United States, and he thought the word busy meant good, because every time he asked someone, how are you doing, they said busy. And so we have this idea that the busyness of our work is an inherently good thing, and our identity is so much tied to our work. But if we step back for a moment, particularly facing the specter of automation, where some of our jobs might not exist in a few years, the idea strikes me as kind of funny, that we derive so much purpose from our work when we could be doing all sorts of other things. And so part of this is to say, how do we deal with automation, making us feel potentially replaceable and potentially less human? Well, we should take joy in the fact that humans can do other things outside of work. We can engage in leisure. We can do all sorts of things separate from our worker identity. And I think that's the attitude that I hope we can move toward.
Right. You also talk about how we can think about human-machine partnerships. In fact, you devote an entire chapter to that and explore some of the different ways in which these partnerships might actually work really, really well. Describe your listeners just the sense in which this can happen in several different ways.
Yeah. Well, probably my favorite example, even though it's not the most sexy example, is in from cybersecurity. And so the basic idea is, one way I think humans and machines can work together is that machines are very good at crunching a lot of data and doing the same thing over and over and over again. What humans are doing, good at doing, as opposed to robots, is spotting deviations from a pattern, spotting outliers, spotting abnormal information. So these very smart folks at MIT built a system to analyze a bunch of data, online material, emails, and to identify, are there any threats to cybersecurity? Are there any viruses or attacks? And the system, you know, crunches tons and tons of information. This would be too much for a human to take in, or it would take a human a very long time. And when the machine works on its own, it's pretty good at identifying cyber attacks, but it ends up identifying a lot of false positives, a lot of things that it thought were cyber attacks but are really mundane. So what the researchers did is they said, I think we can improve on this. We're going to have the machine crunch millions and millions of bits of data, and then occasionally we're going to give a sample of its findings to cybersecurity human experts. The human experts then say, from that sample. You got a few right here, you got a few wrong here. Feed that info back to the machine, and then the human and machine working together are virtually perfectly accurate in identifying cyber threats. So I think, again, even though it's kind of an arcane example, it's a perfect example of how humans and machines working together are often better than either working alone.
Right.
I think there's some hope for the future there.
I also want you to say a quick word about a really intriguing notion you bring up in this chapter about that robots could potentially reduce the emotional burdens that humans face on the job. I think that's very counterintuitive. It's kind of the last thing we would expect a robot to be capable of doing. How do you see that happening?
Right. So the examples I give are at the forefront of customer service. And typically, if you just say the word customer service to people, you don't get a positive response. People don't like calling customer service. Customer service reps are often very burdened. You're dealing with frustrated people. And my personal experience of calling customer service, say, for my cable company or for an airline, is really frustrating because I often need an immediate solution, and I have to go through all these steps online of verifying who I am, talking to a robot, and those systems don't work very well. But newer systems, some systems employed by banks or financial service firms, are using advanced biometric technology that, say, can identify you just from your voice. So if I'm a bank or if I'm a bank customer and I need to have a secure conversation over the phone, I can call this bank and just start talking. And the machine identifies me. It can perfectly route me to where I need to go. And then by the time I get to the customer service rep, I'm less frustrated and I'm taking out less of my frustration on them, so they can help me with a more targeted issue. So that's one way that advanced, if you want to call it robots or robotic systems, can reduce emotional burdens on the job.
Adam Waitz explores other avenues and arenas in which automation is becoming more and more a part of our lives. For instance, when it comes to self-driving cars, he talks about a study in which he engaged trying to determine how much people would welcome the notion of self-driving cars, and much has to do with how self-driving cars are put together and what level of control the human being in the car can retain. He also talks in his book about how when it comes to automation and the creation of robots, a lot has to do with whether or not those robots begin to resemble us, particularly in appearance. And there is a point at which we do not welcome automation to that level because it becomes a more threatening thing. And that's why the key to automation being welcomed into our lives is when automation does not seem to be aping the human being. For instance, something like a smart speaker in no way resembles a person. And so most people do not have any difficulty with allowing that kind of automation into their lives. It's a phenomenon known as the Valley of Eeriness, in which we welcome the increased sophistication of automation to a point until that automation begins to imitate human beings. And at that point, it becomes too human for our comfort, and we regard it as eerie and creepy and threatening, and then want to reject it from our lives. He explores this and many, many other factors of automation in his fascinating book, and he offers this comforting word at one point. Adam Waitz writes, humans will likely stave off automation for longer than predictive models suggest. Machines almost always will be catching up with and learning from humans rather than the other way around. That is, machines need humans. The book, once again, is The Power of Human: How Our Shared Humanity Can Help Us Create a Better World. It's published by W.W. Norton & Company, and the author, Dr. Adam Waitz. I'm Gregory Berg. You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive. We explore today the fascinating and sometimes very challenging world of phobias, and specifically what occurs when someone is assailed with very serious phobias which affect nearly every detail of their daily lives. I'm speaking today with Alan Shawn, who is already a well-known writer. You perhaps have seen his work in Atlantic Monthly. He's written an interesting book about composer Alan Schoenberg, and his newest book is called Wish I Could Be There, Notes from a Phobic Life, in which he talks about the array of phobias which have affected his life for many years, including especially serious agoraphobia and claustrophobia and so on. And he traces some of the possible reasons why his life is one that is lived with the harsh realities of all these phobias and the ways in which he has managed to cope with them and carve out for himself a very successful and happy life. And we speak with him for the next few minutes about all of this. Again, the book called Wish I Could Be There, Notes from a Phobic Life. And Alan Shawn, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Very nice to talk with you, Greg.
Looking forward to this very, very much. So you are afraid of many different things. And when we sort of make a list of them, it's really kind of astonishing to realize how much of a full life you've been able to live, despite the fact that you have a terrible fear of heights and water and enclosed spaces and crowds and so on. In a nutshell, how have you managed to do that?
Well, I should say, first of all, that when I talk to other people with these types of problems, they generally unpack a pretty full suitcase of things that they don't like, just as I do. And it turns out that an awful lot of people suffer from not just a couple of specific things that they don't like, but kind of a whole constellation of things that circumscribes their behavior. But yes, like many people, I have tried to carve out a life that consists of the things that I don't need to avoid and that I don't dread. I teach. I'm a composer first and foremost, a pianist. I teach at Bennington College. I teach music. And I also have started to write in midlife. I started to actually write. I first wrote the book on Arnold Schoenberg, and now I've written this book about really a subject that I wish I could avoid, but which turned out to be so fascinating that I did end up with quite a bit to say about it, as you know.
Right. When you are experiencing, I don't know if we want to call it an attack or what,
sure.
An attack of agoraphobia or one of these other phobias, for instance, you have great difficulty, for instance, if you have to drive over a bridge or in a tunnel.
Yes.
You cannot ride on a subway.
Right.
When you have these attacks, is there something tangible that you are afraid will happen to you, or is it more of a kind of an unnamed and an unspecific sort of dread which you experience?
Well, people tend to think of these types of reactions as being all in your mind, but to the poor sufferer, it's much more like an allergy. You find that every time you go through a tunnel, you have a whole series of physical symptoms, culminating in a lot of thoughts of dread, but it doesn't start by, in a rational way with a thought such as the tunnel's going to cave in on me. It's really much more like a response that you'd see in a cat or a dog or a horse. You want to run, you want to flee. It's the famous fight or flight symptom.
Mm. Well, and you, I know, talk in the book about some of the very real physical symptoms.
Yes.
Which you experience as well. Tell our listeners about the most acute of them.
Well, I think our listeners all know these symptoms, but maybe most people experience them when there's really some danger occurring and they need to respond to it. Rapid heartbeat, shortness of breath, maybe a tightening in the chest or even chest pains, perspiring, tingling sensations, to name just a few. And then, of course, the mental experience of being confused and disoriented and kind of frantic, all of which is really physiological in origin. Although, when it's happening to you, you ascribe it to, really one of two things. You think that you're physically in great danger or mentally in great danger. In fact, what's happening is that your body is responding exactly as it should in a dangerous situation, but at the wrong time.
I think it's especially interesting that you have a terror for closed-in places. And a fear of wide open spaces, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And the wide open spaces reaction is something that only really I noticed when I started to write the book. A lot of these things are so instinctive that I just think of them as part of the world itself, part of life. And I realized, even writing the book, how all of this added up into one giant syndrome that's really a very, very inconvenient, to put it mildly.
Part of your book is an effort for you to maybe untangle some of the possible reasons behind your phobias, and specifically some of the ways in which your challenging childhood in a child challenging home might have at least something to do with why you live with these serious phobias. Yes. I want you to tell our listeners about the interesting story you tell of your mother and what she would be like in the car when your family would be going someplace. This is a really interesting insight into her and maybe into some of her demons.
Interesting that you focus on her, because of course in my childhood my father was much more the person who we all thought of as suffering from anxiety and phobias, but our mother was very much a part of that, because she lived exactly the same way he did, but in a way, her problems were concealed behind his, which were more obvious. And after his death, she didn't really live particularly differently. And she too had an incredible fear of being in an unknown place and not knowing where she was, being lost. And when we would travel to Boston or sometimes through New Jersey, she would always have a map, and she would always be looking at every point along the way. But even going to Lincoln Center from 96th Street and 5th Avenue, she would tell the taxi driver exactly what route to take, where to turn, and she wouldn't dole it. She would dole it out rather slowly, bit by bit,
and politely. You tell us
very politely. Both my parents were amazingly courteous and gentle people, but there was a firm grip there, even on a small journey, as if there were all kinds of dangers out there that you had to be wary of.
Sure. So she would say that the driver would take a certain turn as she requested. Thank you. Now, at the next corner, you will turn right. Thank you. And then on to the next.
Absolutely correct.
And, of course, what I suppose might be at the heart of some of your life of fear, if we should call it that, is that if you saw in her this overwhelming need and desire for utter control, then stepping into any kind of situation which is clearly just beyond your control would be a truly frightening thing.
Yes. I mean, we're talking about how basic, you know, instincts can be molded by your upbringing and by your own habits. I mean, of course, we start with our genetic makeup, and I'm sure that in my family tree, there's a strong genetic tendency towards anxiety. But then, you know, how you're brought up is terribly important, and you're completely right that having both parents who were monitoring their every move so carefully and not terribly spontaneous in the outer world, you know, they were quite spontaneous and adventurous intellectually, but in the outer world, not. Of course, a lot of that rubbed off on me. But then, you know, you can move beyond your upbringing in so many ways. So the mystery is, you know, why one member of a family becomes very much like his parents, you know, in terms of problems such as, let's say, drinking or you know, anger or other kinds of difficulties people have, and another family member is free of them.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
It is.
I wonder, in this life filled with so many phobias, is there a strong temptation for you to confront those things so feared in the hopes that maybe something has happened and maybe you're not going to be afraid of riding the subway, or you're not going to be afraid to go over a bridge or through a tunnel? Or at some point, do you know, without even attempting to encounter those things, that such a thing remains impossible? And is it possible to really know that?
Right. That's a difficult question. You'd hope that such things might just evaporate on their own. I think the only way to get over these types of habits of body and mind, really, is to have positive experiences doing those things, and to demystify them and retrain, really, your very brain to respond differently to those experiences. So I've never stopped pushing myself, although, you know, everybody who knows me wishes I pushed myself more. But, of course, I keep trying all kinds of things in an effort not to discover that I no longer have the responses, because they're so ingrained, but to bit by bit chip away at the habits. I'm really talking about habits that are ingrained in, you know, in the brain itself, to create new pathways in the brain, which sounds, you know, fanciful, except that's exactly what really the experts in the field recommend.
You are, as you mentioned, a music faculty member. I should have certainly mentioned that. I happen to be a music professor myself.
No kidding.
Yeah, right. And you are a composer,
yes.
And of course, one of the things that I'm sure has been especially painful or frustrating for you is the fact that it is tremendously difficult for you to be, for instance, at public concerts, even those where your own music is being performed. And
yeah.
It's hard to think of a more unfortunate scenario than someone who produces, creates music for just such occasions which either you cannot attend yourself or can only do so with sort of gritted teeth and grim determination. Has that become any easier over the years?
Well, I have, you know, ways of turning up at places that are, you know, highly enjoyable, and then there's situations that I simply can't bear. I mean, if I'm, you know, if I had a piece played at Lincoln Center and I could sit on the aisle, there's no problem with that for me. I have a joyful experience at such occasions. But if I have to take a plane or if I have to take an elevator to, you know, to even the 10th floor, the very same experience would be very difficult for me. And even driving, as you suggested earlier, you know, a few hours to a place I haven't been before to hear my own music, I would have to practice the drive as if, you know, as if there's something really difficult for me in the drive itself and in finding my way there, which is even to me astonishing, but it's the truth.
Hmm. I don't have the book in front of me, unfortunately, and I'm trying to remember this for certain. I believe you are or have been married.
Oh, yes.
And have a family. That part, for some reason, was a little bit vague in my mind. And
right, because I don't really bring my personal life into the book much. I deliberately avoid.
Right. I mean, you talk about how, in a sense, you wanted this to be both a personal and impersonal book.
Yes.
And I thought it was for a very laudable reason, because, in a sense, you don't want people so caught up in some of the specific personal details of your own life that they can't sort of see themselves or use the book to help themselves with their own lives and their own particular situations.
Right. That's absolutely right. I mean, I was married for many years, and I was divorced, and I'm now remarried. I have two children, and I'm actually, believe it or not, expecting a third child in July, even though I'm about to turn 60.
Wow.
So, you know, my life is very eventful on the family plane.
Right.
I didn't want the book to be a memoir in the traditional sense. It's about 50% memoir. But I thought there were, because some of the members of my family are quite well known, I thought that it could easily be perceived as basically a book even of gossip. And I wanted it to be about personality and the origins of the many quirks we all have. Mine are, you know, really regrettable and pretty serious, but I think everybody has a personality and has sides of themselves that are mystifying to them. I would almost say that 99% of what we do as we go through our day is mystifying to us.
Hmm.
And I was trying to go deeper into that rather than to just talk about people who are. Well known. So actually, people reading the book don't even notice that I do not use names in my book for the most part, except for my sister. She has a name, and that was for a very specific reason.
This is a sister who is institutionalized?
She is. She's autistic and mentally retarded and suffers from schizoaffective disorder, and she is my twin. And the story of my sister sort of surfaces in the book as really equal in importance to my own story, and a big part of maybe the pain and difficulty behind my current problems. And to be honest, talking about mystification, that surprised me. As I was writing the book, I found that emerged, and
You mean your deep feelings about her and her being institutionalized, and that occurred at the age of 8.
Yes.
So this is a sad circumstance with which you have lived for many, many years.
For many years, and of course, certainly highlights the issue of traveling in a very different way than one might at first expect.
Hmm. We have just passed the 20-minute mark, but if you would permit me, I would love to just have a brief word from you, if you have the time, to just tell us, if you are comfortable, just a little bit about what it has been like to create your own family within the framework of a life that is riddled with these phobias. I guess what I'm curious about more than anything is if you have managed to do that more easily than maybe you would have anticipated at the outset. I mean, what has that experience been like for you?
Well, I've tried to be more honest with my children than my parents were with me about these things. It's a different time, and there's a lot of candor in the air these days that was not there in the 1950s when I was growing up. So I've tried to be honest with them about the difficulties I have, and I've encouraged them to be adventurous in many ways that I have not been, and to try to take from me whatever my good points are. Also, my two children who are now fairly grown up, 19 and 23, their mother is a world traveler and a completely different type of personality, so that's benefited them wonderfully. Being a parent is participating in life, and in evolution, I recommend it. I recommend it to everyone, and I don't think that having these types of handicaps and other kinds, for that matter, should make people there think they're not possibly competent parents. I think everyone has their difficulties, and if you can bring up your children with some honesty about that, and that people are not as depicted in the glossy magazines, and are in fact very complicated and often, almost always flawed, I think you can bring up children who are able to face their own lives.
Sure. Well, and I suppose, I'm sure this impacted family life in many ways. I mean, you probably couldn't, assuming your children were musicians, it was probably difficult, if not impossible, for you to attend most or many of their functions, for instance. But for them to have to come to grips with that and understand your own weaknesses or the difficulties with which you were contending,
right,
that's probably good for any young person to be sort of wrenched out of their own desires and think about someone else and their struggles, even if it's your own father.
Right. You've spoken truthfully. I mean, obviously there's that tug of war between difficulties I have and the needs of others, and tug of war between a sense that this is a character flaw and something more like a medical disability, and that's just the way it is.
The book again is called Wish I Could Be There: Notes from a Phobic Life. It's published by Viking, and a fascinating book start to finish, and its author Alan Shaun. Alan Shaun, I'm so glad that you have written this book, and I'm sure it will be of tremendous help to anyone who lives with this reality, and I think will be tremendously interesting even to those who thankfully are not living with this sort of reality in their lives. We all have a lot to learn from your very interesting story, and I thank you today for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your interesting book. Best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg, and to you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, that is with The Morning Show podcast, you'll hear my conversation with the author of a book called The Life and Crimes of George Carlin, of course, one of the most influential of comedians in recent years. On Sunday, I'm rebroadcasting, again as part of our podcast, a conversation from several years ago with Frank Germanaro and his wife Janet on the 40th anniversary of his first kidney transplant. And that milestone made that kidney one of the longest surviving transplanted kidneys in American history. It's really quite a story that we hear from both of them. That's the Sunday podcast. Monday on The Morning Show, as we broadcast, a very interesting conversation about religious liberty, and in particular, all kinds of efforts underway to try to curb the religious